All right. I've got a long lesson. That's why I get nervous when I have long lessons. So you've been very good about coming back every week, because what I'm doing is not easy for you. And that is go through a paper. I've only done it one other time, and this was sort of an experiment, again, because I didn't know how else to do it. And I did promise you, so that you could go to sleep during class, that if you wanted a copy of it later on, you could read it at your leisure. So I'm going to send this around. I want you to write your name down. If you don't do it today, that's fine, but I need to know. I don't want to make 30 copies, and they all go home and lay somewhere no one reads. And you're in class, when it's been sent around, you got to take a copy, right? You just cannot. Anyway, so I want you to tell me that you want a copy. And since I have your name on it, I'll give you your copy rather than just make it available, because it's 30 some pages long, whatever it is. Yes. They are online. They were off a couple of weeks, so it's Twilight was gone, but they're up there now. Yeah, they're online now. They're up to date today. I'll edit today's, and it'll be online by probably tomorrow night. Yep, and that's a good way to go over it. And even if you have a paper in your hand, you can listen to it. So I even listen to my paper and learn stuff I've written. So it's really funny. It's complicated. It's not easy stuff. Remember, this is God doing things. It's not like just some accident. You know, all these little pieces. So I'll just give it to you and then do this section first and then come down this way. No one's got this except Vicky, because she asked for it last week and I said, I won't do it till I get back, and then I got filled guilty. So I gave her a copy. So anyway, I had to do it anyway. So anyway, it's looks like this, and it's, it'll take a while to read it. And if you don't want it, but you know somebody else could benefit from it, you know, that's fine too. I'm not saying you have to read it, but I just want to make copies that aren't used. And it's not edited, so there are probably stuff wrong in it, but I don't want to know about that. Well, I do. It's wrong, but you miss a word like not, changes the whole sentence. Short introduction. In fact, I get to the end of this thing, I may have to bail out, so we'll just see how we go. We're in the third lesson, remember? Should have been really four. I will give you the land, and God gives them the land. In the meantime, we've got people that have claimed the land. That's the story. It says, the enemy has spoken against you. It says, aha, the everlasting hills or mountains have become our possession. So you have the competition for the land, and it's settled when God says, I will bring you into the land. So that's the background of our story, and it has to do with God's word and what he meant. And it has to do with Abraham's covenant, has to do with the covenant being a contract, blah, blah, blah. We also have this, and we will get into this when we come to the new covenant, which is part of the Abrahamic covenant. Behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant, which is part of the Abrahamic covenant. We'll talk about that, but not yet. I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. The two of them are brought together again. I will put my law within them, and on their heart I will write it, and it will be their God, and they shall be my people. Never been quite like this ever before. Thus saith the Lord, who gives sun for light by day and fixed order of moon and stars for light by night, who stirs up the sea so that the waters roar. The Lord of hosts is his name. If this fixed order departs from before me, declares the Lord, then the offspring before Israel will also cease from being a nation before me. Not a chance. Thus says the Lord, if the heavens can be measured, and the foundation of the earth can be stretched out below, then I will cast off all the offspring of Israel for all that they have done, which is always the charge, for all they have done. God said, no matter what they have done, I will not do it. And that's why we're studying this. All right, that was my short introduction. Now I'll try to go slow. So far, three lessons, we have been introduced to Chaim Weizmann and Nahum Sokolow. These Zionist leaders have brought the quest of a homeland for the Jews in Palestine to an international conclusion, So far, Sokolow has the private approval of the Allies and the Roman Church to do just that. So far, Sokolow has the private approval of the Allies and the Roman Church to do just that, make a homeland for the Jews. So what's left? Surprising. Britain and the United States have not weighed in on this question. Remember, we're in 1917, the great, wonderful, momentous year. Although the courting of England and United States has been the object since late 1914 at the time of the war. So what's left undone to get this thing going? First of all, you have to get the United States aboard, which is where we left it last week. You have to get the United States aboard. They're just too big a power to ignore. Letting the private commitments that have already been gotten for a Jewish state from these various countries, the private commitment of a Jewish state out into the open, retaining all the private commitments gained by Sokol Law. So they have to become public knowledge. Then England will have its turn to support the Jewish state. You notice that England comes in last, not first. So we have Woodrow Wilson and Balfour. But the crucial portion of the story unfolded not in London, but in Washington. Remember, if the United States doesn't get on board, everything falls apart. So the crucial place is Washington. For just as Britain would never have moved on Palestine without the prior consent of its European allies, so it would not have acted without the agreement of Woodrow Wilson. So in early 1917, the United States declared war on Germany, not the Ottomans, making itself a major player in the anticipated post-war settlement. One more ally had to be persuaded before Britain could move, and that was the United States. Here too, Sokolow had an effect, if only because he had recruited Louis Brandeis, a Jewish Zionist, to the cause. This occurred during a whistle-stop visit before World War I. He's making friends. During a whistle-stop visit, Sokolow to America right before the war, March 1913. Sokolow, Wiseman later reminisced, was on the alert for new men, and he found them. He was the Columbus, so to speak, who discovered Louis Brandeis, and it was Brandeis who Wilson named as the Supreme Court Justice in 1916, who led the campaign to gain an American buy-in to the British Declaration. Brandeis was kept fully in the picture about the developments in Europe, about Britain, and on the continent, as Sokolow wrote later. The negotiations in political circles in England and France were known in America, Brandeis. Every success was welcomed there with enthusiasm and often received further support. The American State Department, the American policy establishment, was entirely hostile to Zionism. The Zionist idea seemed so impractical, and even the missionary interest opposed it, which is an interesting branch to go down to find out. Why did the missionary oppose an Israeli nation? Don't want to go that way. On the first ask in September 1917, Wilson had withheld his approval. Only the second time around in mid-October, when Wilson, talking just before the Balfour, mid-October, when Wilson received the proposed text from London, and he put it in his pocket and carried it around him for a long time. I find in my pocket the memorandum you gave me about the Zionist movement. He wrote it to the trusted foreign affairs advisor, House, one of the State Department. He says, I'm afraid I did not say to you that I concurred in the formula suggested by the others, side, but I do, and would be obligated if you would let them know. House did so discreetly. Even Zionist Secretary of State didn't know. So in other words, Wilson gets on board here, and really nobody else knows about it. Didn't want anybody else to know it. So that's the end of the private diplomacy. So now we go to the public. Now it becomes critical, because what you have in private, you have to also do in public, which is a new thing. The idea has finished the incubation stage. There have been no open international recognition of the idea. Sokolow knows that even all the engagement from all the Allied governments in hand, it was vitally important that the plan to go into the public and secure the same commitment there. One defection would all it would be necessary for Britain to abandon the idea, to wit, all my friends may agree to a plan privately, but show my plan to all to see, many could cause some to back out. This is certainly possible in the historic anti-Semitism in Europe. It was important that Sokolow understood that a public acknowledgement of their intention was critical, since it would cement them into continued support. It would be an international disgrace for a nation to make a commitment on action and then on the eyes of the world not to fulfill it. So Sokolow was the originator of the public diplomacy idea. And by the way, all diplomacy anymore is in the public, almost ad nauseum. Nothing done in the secret, then announced. It's all in the public. And we saw everything that happened in Korea. See, I'm off track here, but it's the same principle here. We do everything in the public. Now, everybody in the public. And that's not how it always was. So May 1917, the war cabinet, the British war cabinet, one that kind of decides these things, was still not on board with their commitment. May 1917, remember November is the date, when the Cambon, that's French, letter became indispensable that he got earlier. The historian Isaac Friedman said, who probably weighed more evidence, that letter weighed more evidence than anyone else, believed that without it, there would have been no Balfour Declaration. As for Woodrow Wilson's assent, the British War Cabinet had insisted upon it. Without it, as the diplomatic historian Beecher noted, the Balfour Declaration almost certainly would not have been issued. So letters become important, what they have said, and it's in writing, it helps make it so. Wiseman called it one of the most important individual factors in breaking the deadlock created by the British Jewish anti-Zionists and in deciding the British government to issue its declaration. Remember, so many of the Jews were against it too, besides all the international nations. Might have been against it, but they got them all to sign on. Okay, despite appearances then, the Balfour Declaration is more than a chess move of a single power, which has been our point the whole along here. Behind it stood the Allies, each of whom gave it some push forward. When the Balfour finally issued it, no one doubted that the Allies stood by Britain's side. Don't remember anything else, remember that. That's what we're doing here. We got the world on board with the Jewish state, the world, the Western world. Just after the publication of the declaration, the Jewish Chronicle of London affirmed that British government had acted in accord, it is without doubt to be assumed, with the rest of the Allies. The Zionist Review described the declaration as a formal public recognition by Great Britain that Israel as a nation lives and persists. So the perception is that the British were the first and the greatest proponents of Zionism's aim. As it turns out, it was the last and appears to be almost the most unwilling player, not the most willing. Okay, so now we have this May to November, the public or the public layer of these negotiations. But the Zionists understood perfectly well that the Allies would have to be consulted once more on the day of peace, after the war, which is a year away yet. They knew that the Allies would have to be consulted one more. You know, when you have a disagreement with your wife or with your boss or whatever, and you get an agreement the way you think it should be, and I always found that when I was on staff here that I had working with Gil, that if he gave an agreement to something, I'd have to go back two more times before I really got an agreement. Understand what I'm saying? You want to go back, make sure. Did you understand? Yeah, you're still okay with that? And then you go back one more time. Yeah, I'm still okay with that. That's what's happening here. It's not strange at all. So the Allies would have to be consulted one more time because they're going to be on. They're going to have the necks out here when they're going to support Israel. And if you're not going to do it in public now, you're not going to do it then. So we don't want to be out there on the limb and then we get our branch cut off. So the Zionists understood perfectly well that the Allies would have to be consulted once more at the end of the war. Okay, because the Palestine as a national home for the Jews would be contested. So you want to go in with all your pieces in order, your ducks lined up. The Balfour Declaration thus opened another chapter to which the Zionists worked to persuade each Allied government to endorse it openly. This is something no one knows. Everything this is all done in secret. Now it came out and that's only a British idea. That's not the way it is at all. And we wonder why we're arguing about the land. But God is making the land of Jews, theirs by every way you can look at it. Not only by his promise, but legal, by historic precedent, by moral reasons. They all point to Israel. Here too, Sokolow played the lead in the continent, and it was no small task. Now think about this. Private commitment, now we've got a public commitment, and we're going to have two French government changes. like administration changes. Here, too, Sokolov played the lead on the continent, and it was no small task. It had cooled. America was now well into the war, and Russia is going to be out of it, but in the beginning of 17, had the first revolution, threw off the Tsar, but then later on, we have the communist revolution. America was now well into the war, and Russia was going out, I should have said. So British Jewish opinion on both countries no longer mattered. Remember, the protocols of the elders was a driving force that we have to please these Jews. Now, all of a sudden, Russia out of it, and France had cooled, so the Jews have no force anymore. I mean, you'd think, if they ever had any force. And there had been a change in the government in France since the Carbon letter. So in January, February 1918, after the Mayflower, Sokolov returns to Paris. Get the dates right. He returns to Paris. It's now become a public thing. Now I got to get public support. Sokolov returns to Paris, this time with the aim of securing public French declaration in support of the Balfour Declaration. There he met with a French foreign negotiator, Pigeon, an old friend who assured him that nothing had changed in France's position since the Carbon letter. But Sokolov asked for a formal statement, an explicit French statement on the Balfour, and the American Jews would appreciate it, he said. Sokolov assumed Pinot that this would help France at the peace conference after the war was over. So Pinot delivered an endorsement, and it was published on February 10, 1918. Picot affirmed the understanding is complete between French and the British governments concerning the question of the Jewish establishment in Palestine. Sokolov was not satisfied with this phrase, which fell short of the homeland mentioned by the Balfour Declaration, so he pleaded with Picot to use the phrase national home, and so February 14, Picot sent a letter, another letter did just exactly that. And so the Zionists collected other endorsements, some outright, some with amendments, and the most came from Italy and Japan, two states that, along with France and Britain and France, would participate in the San Remo Conference, still coming up in 1920, 2 years away, and became permanent members of the Council of the Nations, League of Nations. In May of 1918, we have also on board the Italian government, pledged to Sokolov to keep and facilitate and establish the Palestine for a Jewish home center. January 1919, Japan informed Weizmann that Japanese government gladly take note of the Zionist aspirations to establish in Palestine a national home for the Jews, and they look forward to a sympathetic interest in realization of such desire. We have addition to Siam and China, other two then independent states in Asia, all bought into a Jewish homeland in Palestine. And last not least, we have Woodrow Wilson sent a letter to Stephen Wise, rabbi in New York, expressing satisfaction in the progress of the Zionist movement. Since the declaration of Mr. Balfour, whose text Wilson repeated in its entirety, Wise announced that the conjecture of SEM that the Balfour Declaration commanded the president's approval and has been established as a certainty for all. Now, this is just sort of like, remember how this works. On the left, we have green and pink. That's the right colors. The green is the Allied side. The pink is the Axis powers, the German side, Austria, the Ottoman power. And then you have, on the right, you have the red and the tan and the same division, except this basically too, the Ottomans aren't listed there. And then you have in the bottom there, after 1919, how the Allies broke up Europe. And so what you see in Europe today is how it came out of World War I. Virtually, that's how it is, except the Ottoman Empire. So if you've been keeping track of these nations, we have on board for a Jewish state, France, Italy, Japan, Siam, China, United States, and Britain. All the Allies in the Western world after World War I. So the Allied powers of World War I were France, Italy, England, at the end. The Allied powers are the receivers of the lands lost in belligerent actions of the Axis powers, consisting of Germany, Austria, Hungary, and the Ottoman Empire. I go back to this pink stuff. They get to divide all of that up. They get to make new nations out of that or restore old nations. Okay, that's what's happening here. And they have the authority to do it because they are the winning side. All right. Okay, now the Ottoman Empire is off to the side. It's sort of it's inconsequential, really, as the world is concerned. It's just a bunch of sand. It has some oil, but it's just a bunch of sand. and a bunch of Arabs that fight each other most of the time, and they chase their sheep around the desert. That's all you have there. So the Ottoman is really not really important, and so it doesn't get divided up right away. So the Ottoman Empire is off to the side on the Central Territories map. The Ottomans were allies with the defeated Germans. The Ottoman lost the war just as Germany did, to wit, the territories by international law goes to the victor when the belligerent nation is defeated, and they were defeated. The Ottoman territory, not as important, was divided then, later in the London Conference the same year, by the Allied powers. It was an extension of the Versailles Conference. So, I'm going to skip this question of self-determination. There's an idea that self-determination means you go to the people in the land and ask them who they want to be run by. That's not how it works at all. Self-determination had to do with the Jews. They were not in the land. And the question was, where do you want to be? You people, you as a people determine, all right? And it has nothing to do with the Arabs. All right, I'm just going to skip over this just because of the time. But it's a football. Now let's see, where do I go? Pick it up again. Oh, yeah. Okay, now we're talking about secret dealings. I could skip this one too, but this is kind of important. Secret dealings, the cause for further war or misunderstanding. You can't do stuff in the secret when you got partners. Doesn't work very well. It's like keeping secrets from your wife. Doesn't work very well. All right, besides the matter of self-determination is the issue of secret deals made between allied parties as World War I continued. These deals were secret since they were not publicly known. See, there's a not missing. Since they were not publicly known, as expected, there would be objections by those. Oh, if they were publicly known, as expected, then there would be objections. That's okay. By those who were left out of the deal. As the war wore on, as the war wore on, wrong word, it seemed to some that they could get an advantage by claiming land ahead of time to their advantage before the war ended. That's not nice. As if the war is not enough, behind the curtain, deal makers were making further commitments to a third party. It ought to be apparent that partners in an enterprise or a partnership cannot give away part of it without consulting all of them. But lacking any authority, they cannot make deals between each other, nor can they make further deals outside of themselves. And that's what's happening here. So by secret deals, nations cannot make any binding claims. They're illegitimate claims. The principle was understood by Sokolov. He had private agreements of the nations, but then after the British issued their declaration, Sokolov again went to the nations and asked for a public acknowledgement of their acceptance. Not going to have a secret deal. It's going to do it in public. It was critical to get international public support. It becomes very hard or impossible to abandon a commitment and retain credibility when you do this. Trust is lost. We mentioned the Iran deal. It did not have congressional approval, therefore it bore the weight of the man in office. That's it. And now he's out of office. Now what does it mean? Another man come on and changes it. And exactly what happened. So executive orders function largely as secret agreements that do not have or need public support. Back to our history. The Balfour Declaration has often been weighed against earlier sets of promises. 15 and not 16. Britain made various pledges to the Sharif, later the king of Hussein of Mecca, leader of the Arab revolt against the Ottomans, in a series of Arabic letters known as the Mahon correspondence. In these letters, British promised Hussein that they would support Arab independence. Remember, their Ottoman power is going away, so they want to be in its place, support Arab independence within certain borders, at least, very least, Syria and Mesopotamia, and possibly also Palestine. Now, how was it that the Balfour Declaration became international law while the Hussein letter correspondent ended up in a dead letter? Well, the answer is the Arabs had no Sokolov law making provisions in public for these provisions. It was the secret agreement thrown in the drawer and not to be brought up again. And now, when everything's over, now you're supposed to bring out the letter. Oh, it's all over. So no one pleaded the Arabs' cause here, and I'm not saying it would help any, but no one did. So everything remained private, and I say an international oops. Got to get this stuff out in the open. Once Hussein had his secret pledges from the British, once he got that, he threw it in the drawer, made little effort to extract comparable commitments from other allies. In particular, British Sykes tried to press Hussein's son Faisal to act as Sokolov did and come to some understanding with the French over Syria. But the British Mahone had included a key reservation, namely that the territories promised for Arab independence were only those in which Great Britain was free to act. There never was any of those kind of territories where Britain was free to act. It was all tied up with the Allies. So it was a secret agreement that had nowhere to go. Okay, as France's interest in Syria was well known, this should have been a powerful incentive for the Arabs to reach a thorough understanding with the French. But Hussein and Faisal never did. And Faisal came to the peace conference in 1919 without any what they call French chits, in other words, demands for payments. Now, there is this fictitious legend built around the valiant, courageous, and noble Arabs of World War I. Everyone see Lawrence of Arabia, the movie? The Arab revolt against the Ottomans has been made something that could never have taken place from an Arabian night, could have been taken place from Arabian Nights stories. Edward R. Murrow, Puff D.H. Lawrence of Arabia, a British altruist for the Arab cause. But the Arabs made the Arabs into a people we know in folklore, but void of any reality. There was little or no contribution by the Arabs to their liberation. They stood around, though, to collect the spoils. Okay. So we have all this stuff. Everybody's public with it. And now we're going to go to the peace conference. All right. Remember, the British chits, in other words, you owe me, have been given secretly. At the peace conference in Paris, Lloyd George invoked the British commitments to Hussein as though they were binding on France. He's making this effort to make good his promise to the Arabs. Now, for the first time, the secret agreement becomes public. Schoen from France objected. This undertaking has been made by Britain alone, he says. France had never seen it until a few weeks ago. And Lloyd George countered this that France had, for particular purposes, accepted our undertaking of King Hussein. And Picon says, well, how could France? It's a secret agreement, unknown to us. Now, Picot was exaggerating French's ignorance, but because the Macon correspondence was secret, knowledge of it could be denied. So Son Faisal had entered a collision course with France, which in 1920 he occupied Syria, Damascus, and by arms the French threw him out. End of him. So given French determination to rule Syria, a clash would have been difficult to avoid, but the absence of an Arab Sokolov in Paris made it inevitable. No less significant, Mahone's secret pledges were meant for Hussein's eyes only. Remember, it was thrown into the drawer. No one was supposed to know about it. They weren't publicized to the Arabs until long after the war. Too late to bring out secret agreements. The Balfour Declaration was something entirely different. A pledge to the entire people given before the whole world. See the difference? Well, what was the Balfour Declaration then? You've listened to me say this before. I'll go again. The pledge to the world. This was only partly obscured. This weak, almost anemic pledge to the world, almost obscured by the very vehicle in which it was declared. I mean, it was such a weak letter. But the letter was no more than a convenience. Sokolov made light of it at a dinner one time. It's just a letter, remember? If no one does anything with this, it's still going to be just a letter, like the one Hussein threw in his drawer. The letter had no weight. It would have died there, just like Hussein's letter would have died. But it would have died there if it had not had international support. What did that letter provide? The idea of a homeland for the Jew was in the letter. It could have been written on a popcorn bag. Surely the signatures were interesting, but carrying no weight in the international community. Then Lloyd Balfour's signature made no difference. It was only when severally and individually each of the nations signed off on it, and that publicly, gained the status of international law. It has never been rescinded. Once accepted, even international community, it cannot be undone. You cannot undo history. There have been regrets, but history, by its nature, is unchangeable, and I always call it the plowed field. Once the field is plowed, you can't unplow it. No matter how much you like to change how it was, but you cannot change your past or mine. The Balfour Declaration thus anticipates what later became to be called public diplomacy. And the Zionist movement had no use for secret pledges of the sort Britain gave to Hussein. As Herzl insisted at the first Zionist conference in 1897, the movement sought publicly legalized guarantees. Back in 1897, they understood this had to be a public thing because of the volatility there is with the Jewish people, since anything less could be revoked at any time. Herzl took a dim view of the secret interventions and called for free and open discussions subject to constant and complete monitoring by the world public opinion. The aim was to produce a public assurance by any government with control or say over Palestine and have it incorporated into public law. And that's the step. The idea that what we do cannot be undone is a powerful truth that ought to shake us to our bones. We easily buy into the devil's perception that somehow we can have our sin and not affect our downstream life. While there is abundant forgiveness in death of Christ, we cannot undo the history we have plowed. Remember, the next time a bit of gossip crosses our ears, or even if it's true, do they build or do they destroy? We are not conducting any secret diplomacy, said the London speech in 1917. Such a thing is obvious and possible for a Jewish people. The Zionist leaders are endeavoring to make clear their powers, the aspiration of the Jewish people. In 1919, insisted that in the whole proceedings, there's no secret treaties, no secret diplomacy. In fact, neither diplomacy nor conspiracy. But they constitute a series of negotiations, schemes, suggestions, explanations, messages, journeys, conferences. While Sokolow may seem like a diplomat, even to professional diplomats, he thought like a publicist, eager to get the story out, to get every assurance he received to make it public. Sokolow saw no point in discretion for discretion's sake. By mid-1917, he told the London audience that he and Weizmann had been abundantly successful in winning over the French, the British, the governments, and that successes with the Italian government had transcended all our expectations, and that Pope Benedict had given him the warmest assurance of his sympathy. News of Sokolow's audience to the Pope spread so widely it gave rise to a joke. There were two Jews finding themselves on St. Peter's Square, where they see two figures standing on the papal balcony, and the one Jew asked the other Jew, "Who's next to Sokolow?" Wilson explicitly asked that this prior approval of the Balfour Declaration not be made public, and it wasn't. Now, this is the United States. But the Zionists publicized every other assurance. This had the dual purpose of spurning competition among the Allies and raising the morale of rank-and-file Zionists. But above all, an open assurance communicated to the vast public could only be retracted at a cost. Indeed, had the Balfour been issued as a secret letter to a Zionist leader without having been cleared by the Allies, that is like the Hussein letter, it would have never entered the preamble of the mandate, and Britain probably would have disavowed it in 1920. In 1923, in light of growing Allied or Arab opposition, a new British government did order a review of the Palestinian policy. Could the Balfour Declaration be abandoned? Remember, Britain turns anti-Semitic after this thing gets signed. There's a change in leadership in Britain. The review committee noted that declaration had been accepted, not indeed without some reluctance, by the whole of the Allies, that it met with special favor in America, that it was officially endorsed at San Ramos, that it figured on the Treaty of Original Severus, Treaty of Sevres, and that it was textually reproduced in the mandate for Palestine, which was officially submitted and approved by the Council of League of Nations July 1922, at the end of this whole thing. Under these circumstances, it was nigh-high impossible for any government to extricate himself without a substantial sacrifice to consistency and self-respect, if not honor. That's where the Jews put all the nations in their support. The British would no doubt have had fewer qualms about violating the secret agreement made only to the Jews. But a public pledge that had been cleared then and seconded by the Allies was another matter. Britain wasn't yet prepared to sacrifice honor on that scale. So Weizmann wanted full credit for the Balfour Declaration. We kind of mentioned this. I'm going to leave this go here, because why wouldn't Sokolow, why was his contribution known? Well, Weizmann sort of the big hog in the room. No pun intended there. He just sort of takes over, and Balfour didn't do that, so we don't know about Balfour. We know about Weizmann. All right. That's just a comment. The British and the execution of the mandate. For Weissman led the Zionist struggle to hold Britain to the promises. This is now after the war. To close what he recognizes the gap between the promise of the Balfour Declaration and its performance. But by late 1930s, Britain was in full retreat from the declaration. In the British White Paper 1939, Zionists saw its final obligation. The White Paper, which limited immigration to Israel by the Jews, the White Paper, which informed British policy throughout the World War II, blocked Jewish immigration of all people. At precisely the moment when the Jews of Europe faced destruction, Britain attempted to set Palestine on a course to become an Arab state with a Jewish minority. These decades in every way put the Jews at a disadvantage in the land. While Jewish immigration was discouraged, inconvenienced, or denied, the Arabs moved in without invitation. Jews became the subject of attack by incoming Arabs who were roused to resist anything Jewish. The Jews were forbidden arms to defend themselves against the Arabs, the Arabs had no such restriction. The reason was that the Jewish limitation on immigration ostensibly was because the land cannot support greater population, but let the Arabs in. The argument is a thin veil. If that were true, then Arab immigration should have been limited as well. Really, what reality was that as the Jews developed their land, it brought economic opportunity to these territories that had not been available elsewhere. Thus, non-politically minded Arabs immigrated to find work provided by Jewish development. That is a true fact. And then they came. So we have failed to mention the egregious acts of the British government at the beginning of the mandate. As in France, there rose a government that knew not Joseph. The new government State Department head was Bevins, was fiercely anti-Semitic, and that's an understatement. The Jewish Virtual Library says, in July 1922, the League of Nations entrusted Great Britain with a mandate for Palestine. Shortly after, in September 1922, the League of Nations and Great Britain decided that the provisions for setting up a Jewish national home would not apply. They decided it would not apply to the areas east of the Jordan River, which constituted 3/4 of the territory set aside in the mandate, which now eventually became the Hashemite Kingdom of Jordan. And I think there is a little bit of guilt feeling on Britain's part. They promised the secret agreement to Hussein that this is a payback for that because they got an Arab nation out of it. It's called Jordan. What honorable explanation for this British giveaway may relate to this letter, which I just said. But these secret agreements really are null and void, thus carry no obligation because they did not have the recognition of the Allies. The support of the League of Nations had no weight in international law. They couldn't divide the land. Therefore, a payoff to the Husseins became an excuse for the British to exercise their latent anti-Jewish sentiment and introduce the idea of Arab rights to the land. See, that's what happened when they gave away some of the land. Now, the Arabs think that not only do they have rights to some of it, they're going to turn around and say, we got a right to all of it. As history has shown, once the Arabs were granted some land, they found that they could insist on all of the land. That stance continues until today, and likely until the Lord will intervene. I don't think there's going to be a solution here. If the British had been faithful administrators, conflict still would have occurred, but once the Arabs saw light between the British and the Jews, they moved right in and capitalized on it. The world with little interest in Jewish rights can easily succumb to Arabs' historic rights to the land, which don't exist. A writer, as the sun set on Britain's support for Zionism, Weissman argued that Britain hadn't the right to discard or even interpret the Balfour Declaration on its own, and I agree. Not because its text had appeared in the preamble of the League of Nations mandate by 1939. By that time, the League was in tatters. I didn't explain that. I just skipped that. All right. Instead, Weissman Call cited the World War I commitments made to Zionism by other allies. We've gone over this many times. Britain had the moral right to rule by Palestine only because the civilized nations of the world had conferred it for the explicit and direct purpose of helping to build up the Jewish national home. And these nations did so because of Zionist exertions. Did not the British government of the time in 1917-18 encourage us, the Jews, the late lamented grieving leader Sokolov, myself and other friends who were working on the cause of Great Britain and Palestine to go to France, Italy, the America? I do not exaggerate this contribution. The mandate should be given to the British, should it not be, and they were encouraged to do so. Well, we were encouraged to bring our people, the Jews say. We were encouraged to pour out all that is best in us because we trusted in the word of Britain. It was for us the rock on which we were to build Palestine. Kramer, thus did Weizmann at his lowest ebb admit the true character of the Balfour Declaration. It had not legitimized Zionism. It was Zionism through its diplomatic efforts among the civilizations which had legitimized the Balfour Declaration. Not only had its insurance depended on the tacit and explicit agreement of the Allied powers, but that agreement had been secured by Zionists themselves, Weizmann, Brandeis, and above all, the lamented but forgotten Sokolow. Aren't you glad? Okay, it's time to chip away at the distorted assertions of a century. The largest of these is the notion that the Balfour Declaration rose out of a legitimate framework as the initiation of a self-dealing imperial power, England, is utterly false. The Balfour wasn't the isolated act of one nation. It was approved in advance by the Allied powers whose consensus then constituted the only source of international legitimacy. Before Balfour signed his declaration, leaders, states, and other democratic nations signed their names on similar letters and assurances. The Balfour anticipated a world regulated by a consortium of principal powers, the same world that 30 years later would pass the UN Revolution, legitimizing the establishment of the Jewish state. It is time to remind the governments of this shared responsibility for Britain's pledge to establish a Jewish national home in Palestine. In Washington, Paris, Rome, and Vatican City, it is important for Israel's ambassadors and friends to speak openly to the historic and essential role of each government in the gestation of the declaration. The same should be done in all of the capitals. This is our author writing all this. The same should be done for all the capitals that endorsed the Balfour Declaration after its insurance, but before it was also enshrined in the mandate that it would include Beijing and Tokyo. The American role deserves particular interest or emphasis. A few Americans know that Wilson approved the Balfour Declaration in advance, or that this approval was a decisive effect in the British cabinet, even though that was secret. The United States never entered the League of Nations, so never ratified the mandate. But in June 1922, the United States Congress passed a joint resolution, the so-called Lodge-Fish Resolution, that reproduced the exact text of the Balfour Declaration, the United States of America for the establishment of Palestine, so on and so forth. President Warren G. Harding signed the resolution the following September. The centennial is a unique opportunity to remind the American public of these facts, all of which point to American shared responsibility in the Balfour Declaration. Now, we are pleased to know the United States, with its ebb and flow support of Israel, continues to be Israel's best friend in a hostile world. We have seen the ugliness in the world whose word is not kept and the damage it caused not only the Jews but all the Arabs in the world whose families mourn the loss of their sons and daughters, a senseless fight to gain something they can never have. A strong stand at the beginning of the mandate period would have kept the intention of the nations intact as an act that God has obviously authored. We have just had another lesson. What happens to nations who do not fear the Lord God and in direct denial of every simple historic truth attempt to make the world to their own liking? We're going through that again in our own country. So the Lord, the God of heaven, who spoke to me and swore to me, saying to your descendants, I will give this land. That's what's behind this whole thing. And the world has been against it since God spoke it. Amen. What could be clearer?